Support for the Real College Podcast comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K. It's the Real College Podcast. I'm Patrick Sharkey, filling in for Matthew Curtis as he gallivants in Panama City Beach this week. This week we're looking at social issues. First, Matthew Curtis will discuss sexual education on college campuses, and later I'll get us up to speed on the FBI versus Apple encryption debate. We'll also hear from producer Jackie Ronzetti as she presents this week's Word on the Street, and we're trying a new segment. All of this and more coming up right now. Let's go.
Lay me down to shut my eyes. Beaded gazes. Lead you nowhere anyways. Press on my heart.
We'll begin today's show with a story about two things that don't typically go together. Matthew Curtis and the female orgasm. I kid, but Matthew took a look into the politics of sexual education on college campuses and found that students are grasping for more knowledge on sexual health, but don't necessarily know where to find it.
The St. Paul Student Center is abuzz with snickering and giggles. Every seat within eyesight is filled. These students and adults believe they're in for the educational ride of a lifetime. And with a name like I Heart the Female Orgasm, you'd expect a similar experience. A lone petite woman, modestly dressed, takes the stage. Her confidence and likability are soon unveiled as she regales the crowd with the story of what brought her here in the first place.
So I got to college and I had never explored my own body, never had an orgasm. And in college, there actually was a workshop on masturbation for men and women. And it was just a dean giving a lecture about the subject. And I attended this workshop, and they recommended some books, went out and got a book, and thought this was so remarkable. Just, I could not believe that I was in my 20s until this happened, and I couldn't believe my body could do this amazing thing.
Dorian Salott is a sex educator and has been doing this for years, traveling from campus to campus all across the country, informing all parts of the gender spectrum about the way their body works.
And I just thought the subject of orgasm was so interesting to me, I decided I wanted to learn everything I could about it. And I really started, sort of led us down the path of teaching about it together at other colleges and universities, and also writing our book, I Love Female Orgasm, about it.
This event was organized by the U of M's Women's Center, the oldest campus-based women's center in the country, aimed at advancing equity for female staff, students, and faculty, and booking national speakers like Dorian and her husband Marshall to speak about topics such as these. I had a chance to speak with Peg Holmquist, director of the Women's Center, to find out more about their involvement with this fascinating event.
So this year, we thought we would select someone who could talk more about sexual health. And we also, from our evaluations and needs assessments, this was one topic that students in particular had said that they would wanted to learn more about.
An event dedicated almost entirely to orgasms gets its fair share of press. I Heart the Female Orgasm has been highly sensationalized and has received much backlash from conservative media, such as talk show host Rush Limbaugh, The New York Post, and the UK's own Daily Mail. Writer for the US News, Peter Roth, criticized it as a hedonistic insult to taxpayers, leading to the moral decay of society.
It's always interesting when people who have never attended the event start, you know, using words like tasteless, and I think, well, have you ever been there? Because I've never heard anyone who's attended our program describe them as tasteless. And to me, this was a program being organized by the Women's Center, which is, you know, focused around educating women about all kinds of issues related to women's lives, and women's sexuality is one piece of that. So from my perspective, it seemed like a perfectly appropriate and natural thing to have happening on a college campus, and one that happens at state and private universities, large and small, all over the country for, you know, for a decade now. So I'm not sure there's a whole lot of news there.
With a public university spending $3,500 on something so liberal, it makes a firm statement. And that statement is something that the Women's Center stands by. But is it worth it? Sex, masturbation, and orgasms are all swept under the rug and deemed highly tabooed subjects. But Dorian argues that this don't ask, don't tell attitude towards female sexuality is destructive and hindering.
I understand your body wants it.
Most adults are sexual adults. Most people want to experience pleasure in their lives. That may be in a marriage, it may be in a long-term committed relationship, however that comes together for them. Most people want that to be part of their lives. And we live in a society that really, you know, keeps it pretty hush-hush, doesn't spend a lot of time talking about it. And I think for a lot of women, they get the message that they're a bad girl if they take an interest in learning about that. So being able to say, you know, it's okay to be a grown-up and educate yourself about this subject the same way you learn about any subject that relates to your life is okay to do. think that's so important for women.
At one point in the night, the genders were separated, and the gentlemen were escorted downstairs by Marshall, and I joined them. It was an opportunity for guys to ask questions without fear of embarrassment or judgment. And unlike any other lecture I've attended at the U, I saw a dozen hands immediately shoot up, eager to know the answers to these burning questions from someone informed in the field. Marshall posed the question of what if they taught driver's ed like they teach sex ed? Sure, you'd know what a carburetor looks like and you would know how to put on a seatbelt, but you'd also be told that driving is dangerous and you should never drive. It was clear at that moment that sex ed was highly important and the people needed to know the answers to these questions. And when the final applause was sounded, I was almost disappointed that the entire student body wasn't there. Sex surrounds our society, especially in college. But if accurate information isn't appropriately learned, people will seek other sources, such as pornography, and only bad will come of it. To have healthy sexual lives, we need to come to the realization that sex exists, and we should spend some time learning about it, the right way. This is Matt Curtis with CultureQ.
We'll now turn our attention to a brand new segment here at the Real College Podcast, so new it doesn't even have a name. The goal? Introduce students and non-students alike to the wide range of student groups we have here at the University of Minnesota. To kick things off, Jackie Renzetti talked with the U's very own Juggling Club.
This week on the Real College Podcast, we wanted to learn more about the different student groups here at the U. Today I'm joined by the president of the Juggling Club, which meets about three times a week. You might see them out on the mall or inside Northrop. They also perform at various student group or sporting events, and every year they put on their own two-day flip fest here at Kauffman Union. So, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us your name and what your major is?
Okay, sure. Yeah, my name's Yang Sim. I'm a junior majoring in economics and minoring in psychology.
Cool. And you're the president of the Juggling Club.
Yes, I am.
Very cool. So, how did you first find out about the Juggling Club?
It was during freshman year. I just saw a couple of people juggling outside of the mall, and I just decided, and yeah, so I just joined them, and then just started juggling with them. And then after a while, I heard that they were going to a juggling festival in Missouri. So that's when I started to, you know, like really get involved into it.
That was interesting that you said that you joined them because you first saw them juggling out in the mall.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering then, is that how a lot of members join, or are there other ways that you guys promote the club right now?
Usually that is the case. We get members when they like see us juggling outside at the mall area, like outside Walter Library. We usually tell them, hey, you know, you should come juggle. It's really easy. And usually they'd be pretty hesitant at first. They'd say, oh, I can't do this. I have no hand-eye coordination at all. Usually they end up learning to juggle a good 5-10 minutes.
Wow, like complete newcomers who have never juggled before?
Yep. As president, I make this claim that I can teach a person how to juggle 3 balls in 10 minutes. Usually they make it within 5 to 8 minutes.
Wow.
Like actually, yeah. A few days ago, I actually taught someone how to juggle in 1 minute and 40 seconds.
Wow,
that was really impressive.
What does that mean? They were juggling within a minute and 40, like
three balls.
Wow, in a minute and 45.
Yep.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, it's, some of these people, they learn really, really fast.
So how do you think that is? How are they able to learn so quickly?
I don't know. I think one thing I took away from that is that that you really have to believe in yourself. Like a lot of people, you know, they get intimidated by the thought of juggling because, oh, you know, juggling is just something very foreign to them. You know, it's something they never thought they'd do. But what they don't realize is that juggling is actually really easy. It's really not that bad at all.
How often do you think somebody will come up to you guys and, you know, when you guys are juggling out there on the mall, how often does somebody come up and ask how to do it?
Not very often. Usually people usually get intimidated by juggling, like I've mentioned earlier. Usually what we do is we would go up to them. Like sometimes you get a person walking by and I just toss a ball to them, think fast. And then I tell them, oh, I can teach you how to juggle in 10 minutes. And usually they go, oh, I can't do it. I have no hand-eye coordination. There's no way I can do this. 3 minutes later, they'd be juggling three balls as if they'd been doing it for years.
Wow, that is so cool. And do they ever stick around after that? Like, is that how you guys get members sometimes?
We usually get a couple of people who stick around. For the most part, again, a juggling club is one of those clubs where it's super chill. You know, there's no like obligation where, oh, you know, you have to come to a set number of meetings per week in order to stay in the juggling club. It's super chill. People come and go. And we don't have a lot of consistent regular members. Usually just, you know, people come by. And like the whole idea like behind the juggling clubs, you know, is just to relax and have a good time.
Very cool. So how do jugglers keep continuing to learn new tricks?
So like in the juggling club, usually we'd be teaching each other trick. You know, like when it comes to like juggling tricks, it's not usually one is like harder than the other. We usually end up like exchanging tricks as well. A lot of people learn them online as well. You can just watch, there are a lot of YouTube videos out there. And yeah, some people just end up making tricks on their own, which is very, very common. And that's one of my favorite parts about juggling.
Cool. So what types of tricks might they invent on their own?
Well, I guess there are like many aspects to it. Sometimes they like juggle maybe like a ball, a juggling club, and a ring together, like simultaneously. So like using three different props. Like sometimes they try to push the limits. They try to like juggle 11, 13 balls at once.
Wow.
So yeah, there's just like countless ways you can like invent new, make up new tricks.
I remember I was able to meet with one of your guys' presidents a little bit a while ago. And they were telling me that something that they think sets apart juggling as like an activity, something that sets it apart from like other activities that you might do, like random sports, is that you could just like walk up to somebody mm-hmm. and learn how to juggle.
Yeah.
How would you describe like the juggling atmosphere between jugglers or between people who are interested in juggling?
Yeah, sure. It's super, super chilled and relaxed. No pressure at all. No one's going to judge you. It's a good way because pretty much everyone's on the same boat. You know what I mean? Understands each other, what they're going through. You know, like a professional juggler who can do like 10 or 11 balls would totally understand, like, you know, what a new juggler would be going through. And it's super chill, very, very good vibes, very friendly people. Also, like, jugglers are just like pretty easily approachable. You just ask them, can you teach me how to juggle three balls? And you know, they'd usually be more than happy to teach you. We really want to foster a friendly juggling community. You know what I mean?
Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, was there anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I would like to reiterate that I claim that I can teach any one of you to juggle three balls in 10 minutes. And we usually have at the very least 80% success rate. Most of them usually end up juggling in 5 to 8 minutes. So yeah, don't be intimidated by juggling. It's really not as hard as you think it is. I promise you that.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming in. It's been really great having you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me here. It's definitely an honor.
Well, thank you. And now we'll get back to the Real College Podcast.
Apple has taken a huge stance in favor of privacy in their legal battle with the FBI. This past week, I took a look at how we got to this point and what both sides are arguing for.
On December 2nd, 2015, Syed Farouk and his wife Tashfeen Malik opened fire on the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino, California.
Welcome back, everybody. We have breaking news coming to us out of California, San Bernardino, where we have the sheriff's office confirming that they've had an active shooter where they have at least...
The couple killed 14 people and seriously injured another 22 before being killed themselves by police. 14 days later, President Obama spoke from the White House.
So this was an act of terrorism designed to kill innocent people.
As part of its ongoing terrorism investigation, the FBI has been attempting to gain access to the iPhone that belonged to Syed Farouk in hopes that it would contain information regarding other terrorist plots or perhaps contain connections to other terrorist cells. But that's where it gets complicated. In February, the FBI announced it was unable to get past Farouk's iPhone's encryption and asked Apple to help. So, I spoke with Casey Carmody, a University of Minnesota PhD student studying media law and ethics and the editor of the Scylla Bulletin, to get a little more insight into what exactly the FBI is asking Apple to do, why Apple is resistant to do it, as well as to try to understand the legal implications that this case may carry.
The FBI wants to get access to some of the information on his phone. The only problem is that a few years ago, Apple changed their privacy settings. They said, hey, the only way people can access this phone is when they put in their unique passcode. Then that's the only way we can get in. So Apple doesn't have the key or anything like that. So everything on the phone is encrypted. And the big problem for the FBI is that if you enter a wrong passcode up to 10 times, then everything on the phone erases.
So, the FBI asked Apple to help its agents defeat the specific feature that was preventing access to the iPhone's data. Apple refused, citing its customers' privacy. The FBI then got a court order requiring that Apple create the requested software, which Apple again has since resisted. So why is Apple so hesitant to create a backdoor into a terrorist's iPhone if it might help the FBI catch more terrorists?
And I think Apple's big concern, like, they probably have two big concerns. One, that, you know, if they do this once, then the FBI may come back and say, in future cases, hey, we want you to do this. So they're worried about that. But the other problem that they're worried about is that, hey, what if this information gets out? So essentially, like, once we bypass, once we create kind of a runaround of security, other people can exploit that sort of problem.
Shortly after news broke regarding the FBI's request of Apple, polling data from the Pew Research Center showed a strong support of the FBI. Specifically, 51% of Americans said that Apple should help to unlock Farouk's iPhone, compared to the 38% who felt Apple should stand pat. Since then, many tech companies, including Microsoft, Facebook, and Twitter, have announced their support for Apple in this battle, and many civil liberties organizations, such as the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, have also joined Apple's side. Now, 2 weeks later, a Wall Street Journal poll suggests public opinion over the matter is now split. But I thought I'd see for myself, so I loitered outside a local Apple store to try and gauge the opinion of some local Apple consumers.
I thought it was pretty cool that they put out a letter and explained why they believed in privacy of their customers and things like that. Before, it wasn't really an issue that I knew a little bit about it, but didn't really care that much about it. I don't really think that I'm the kind of person the FBI is interested in. I understand why the FBI wants that information, but I agree with Apple in that I don't think that it would only be used in this case or that the FBI could contain the information on how to get into an iPhone.
I also spoke with an Apple retail employee under the condition of anonymity.
We haven't really received anything directly from corporate. We're kind of treating it the same way we treat any other sort of media type event. I've just been asking customers their own opinion on the matter. What do they think about it? So everybody that I've talked to about it has been in support. I think it's great. I think Apple's probably the best company I have worked for, and the fact that they are not being pushed around and take each and every customer's privacy concerns seriously, not selling information, things like that, I think it's pretty valuable.
The FBI and Apple are the latest forces to go to battle in the debate of privacy and safety and are at a crossroads as to where the two intersect.
For the Real College Podcast, I'm Patrick Sharkey.
Real College Podcast. I'm Jackie Renzetti, here to bring you Word on the Street. Kicking off spring break on Monday at the Cedar Cultural Center, you can catch an all-ages show with National Act Maiko, along with Marie Digby and Twin Cities artist Daniel Sun. Here's a Maiko track from 2015. This one's called Raincoat Song.
I saw you with her the other day, looking like you're happier this way, but I know that you think about me. She is having your baby. Do you think it was a mistake? Should've worn your raincoat that night. Well, I know.
What's become a bit of a Minneapolis tradition, Drake Night returns for Drake Night 5 at First Avenue on Thursday. Since its first installment last November, the event has traditionally sold out, attracting up to 1,200 people. If you're interested, you can come by for the best Drake gifts, laser lights, a photo booth, and hours upon hours of Drake music.
Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. And I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline blink, that can only mean one thing. Ever since I left the city, you got a reputation for yourself now. Everybody knows and I feel left out. Girl, you got me down, you got me stressed out. Cause ever since I left the city, you started wearing less and going out more. Glasses of champagne out on the dance floor. Hanging with some girls I never seen before. You used to call me on my cell phone.
You may have not been able to make it to South by Southwest this year, but that's okay, because on Friday, First Avenue presents its Midwest Day Party. This show's got two different stages and a killer lineup, featuring Harmar Superstar on his way back from Austin, as well as Bad Bad Hats, Night Moves, and The Blind Shake. From their 2011 release, Seriousness, here's the track Hurricane by The Blind Shake. Capping off the week Sunday, Birthday Suits headlines a show at the Turf Club, along with Jungles and Color TV. The local punk rockers Birthday Suits released their most recent album last year. Here's a track from that record called Golden Week. That's it for Word on the Street. I'm Jackie Renzetti, and you're listening to the Real College Podcast.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Real College Podcast, who is, as always, supported by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. A reminder that you can catch us on air every Sunday at 6 p.m. on Radio K, both online and on the air. But if you miss the show, fret not. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes or whichever podcatcher you use. My thanks to Matthew Curtis and Jackie Renzetti for their contributions to today's show. And a special thanks to Yongyun Sim, president of the Juggling Club, for being our guinea pig of sorts for our first ever club interview. To play us out, we're listening to Rat Boys with their song Charles Bernstein from Radio K's weekly release Spotlight. I'm Patrick Sharkey. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Thank you.